talk to many physicists. And it's nice to talk to physicists, you know, people who understand or appreciate physical arguments. And so that's actually been quite a pleasure coming here to the Perimeter Institute. So black holes, of course, are extremely well studied, widely studied in astronomy, astrophysics, because there's a huge amount of very interesting phenomena associated with astrophysical black holes. And I am, of course, interested in a lot of those things. But putting on my physics hat, to me, there are two things that are really extraordinary about black holes. One I discussed yesterday, the fact that they have an event horizon. It's just an extraordinary concept, and therefore I've been interested in trying to see whether it's really true or not. The second extraordinary thing is the fact that black holes are extremely simple. So, at least classically, a black hole can be described completely with just three numbers. Mass m, spin parameter a star, this is a dimensionless number, defined such that the angular momentum is related to the mass by this relation. And this a star is some number between 0 and 1. That's all that's allowed. And then in principle, our black hole can have charge, electric charge, except that we have pretty strong astrophysical arguments for thinking that charged black holes are probably not present in the universe. That is, they may have some little charge, but not dynamically important charge. So we can ignore charge. So here we have this extraordinary statement that big macroscopic object, which may be, you know, several times the mass of the sun or a billion times the mass of the sun, is completely described with just two numbers. And so what we would like to do is firstly measure these numbers for at least a subset of our black holes. And then, of course, the next step would be to then, having measured the numbers, in some fashion test, see whether it is true that two numbers are enough to describe the object. That is to say, do we need additional parameters? Is it true that our black hole has no hair? Do we need extra hair to explain it, etc., etc.? We aren't there yet. In fact, until recently, we didn't even have two parameters for any of our black holes. And what I'm going to discuss today is recent efforts to try and measure the second parameter. This guy had been measured for a long time. This had been very difficult. Finally, we are getting somewhere, and I want to tell you where we have come in our efforts to measure A star. The particular objects I'll be discussing are these black holes, the stellar mass black holes, mass typically 10 times the mass of the sun. In these X-ray binaries, this is my black hole. That's the companion star. And as you saw yesterday, as I discussed, you have this mass transfer spiraling in gas, getting hot, producing X-rays. And sometimes these systems also have these jets. Ejection, I mean, not just radiation, but actually matter being ejected relativistically. I'm not going to say much about this. I'll say a little bit right at the end of the talk, if there is time. OK, so these are the systems I'm interested in. And a table just to show that people have been measuring masses of these objects. This is an almost complete table of black hole X-ray binaries with mass measurements. I think there are 21 objects here, and maybe there are 22 with mass measurements today, but this is pretty complete. So here are the mass estimates of these particular black holes. You know, there are uncertainties in each case, but essentially every one of these objects is too massive to be a neutron star. So we believe that they're all black holes. And in fact, some subset of these, I did mention in my talk yesterday, we also think we can show that they have event horizons. That's not today's talk. Yeah.
Are the errors on these primarily due to Sinai, or are they primarily due to distance?
Both. Sinai is a serious problem. So this is, you know, the way these masses are measured, you've got a binary. And you basically study the motion of the companion star, and then you apply Newton's laws to that. But in doing that application, you need to know the orientation of the binary, because what you measure is the line of sight velocity, and what you want is the real velocity. So sine I being the inclination, is something that you need to estimate independently. And people have various methods of doing it with their uncertainties. So that's part of the reason why we don't have really precise mass measurements for many of these systems. The additional uncertainty is the unknown distance, where again we do our best. But the good news is that many of these systems have very strong lower limits on the mass. You know, I won't go into the details, but there is a so-called mass function. So there is a fantastically robust lower limit for the mass that you can measure just from simple dynamical measurements. It doesn't give you the actual mass. The mass could be anything above that. To get the actual mass, you need the inclination, you need the distance, and all this additional stuff. But just to get the lower limit is very easy. And so many of these systems, these are the lower limits. Many of these systems have lower limits that are themselves greater than three solar masses, so we think that they are definitely black holes.
But also the companion masses, that's another avenue, I suppose, and they're peculiar, right?
They are peculiar, but I must tell you, the companions, typical system in that table, I would say 80% or more of those systems, the companion mass is very small compared to the black hole mass. So black hole may be 10 solar masses, this one may be half a solar mass. So when it's that small, it really is like a test particle. Its own mass is it may give you a few percent error, but it's not a serious error. So in fact, the companion mass is not the serious error, but what you mentioned, the inclination and the distance, those are the uncertainties. But anyway, this table is just to show you that, you know, people have been doing mass measurements, and this has been going on for, I would say, most actively for the last 20 years or so, but I mean, it goes back to the 70s. This has been done, and the question is, how do we do spin? And this is the point I want to start with. Mass is easy to measure, subject to these, you know, these uncertainties. Because all you need is one test particle at any distance you please. You just measure its orbit, how long it takes to go around, how fast it moves. These are things we can measure. And it doesn't matter at what distance you put it, you're just using Newton's laws, which is the weak field limit of GR, and everything is fine. Now, at those distances, while you are sensing the mass of the black hole, you have no information of the spin. Spin has an effect on the metric only close to the black hole. So you need not a test particle at, say, a million Schwarzschild radii. You need test particles close to the horizon. Only then can you really see additional effects you expect. So this is what has been holding back this field. People really, I mean, we don't have certainly stars that close to the black hole. We have the accretion disk, so that's the good news. We do have these test particles down here, but then you need to develop tools to take the radiation from these test particles and say something about the metric. And this has been going on for a long time, and kind of three methods have been discussed. I'm going to talk about the first of these methods, which involves fitting the X-ray continuum spectrum. So that's what today's talk is about. There is a second method that is widely discussed based on a relativistically broadened ion line. I'm not going to say much about that. Very little about that, in fact. And then there's a third method, which is in some sense really not a method that's being practiced, but rather a method that people have great hopes for. This is a method in which what you say is, you look at a system, and you look at its variability. And many of these black hole binaries have quasi-periodic fluctuations in their X-ray flux. So something is periodic, not perfectly periodic, but at least tending to be periodic. And the idea is that frequency must somehow be related to orbits close to the black hole. And it's that somehow that is holding us back. You know, different people have different ideas on how to relate an observed frequency to some information about the metric. It hasn't quite worked out. There are many ideas. We don't know which of those is right. So this is waiting. It's a method that's really waiting for a model. And when the model comes along, assuming we have reasonably good X-ray data, I think this is going to start giving us spin estimates. That's the hope. But as of now, it is not a method that's working. These are the tools that are kind of being applied and producing results. And I'm going to talk only about the first one. So the work I'm going to talk about is something that we have been doing for the last maybe 3, 4, maybe even 5 years. And a number of us have been involved. So at the Harvard Smithsonian, Jeff McClintock and I are leading this effort. Jeff is a distinguished X-ray astronomer. So he brings the observational expertise, and I provide the theory and the modeling and things like that. Lots of people helping us out, students, postdocs, and even senior people like Mark Reed, Ron Remillard, et cetera. I would like to make special mention of graduate student Rebecca Shafi, who just graduated this fall. So her thesis was largely, I mean, her thesis was entirely work on this project and a part of what I'm going to describe today. We have gone beyond her thesis, but she has played a big role. Essentially, every method that people talk about for measuring black hole spin finally comes down to this concept of what's called the innermost stable circular orbit, which I'm sure everybody here is familiar with. Namely that in general relativity, if you have a compact mass and you put a test particle in, say, circular orbit around the mass, well, we know that at large distance, it pretty much behaves like Newtonian physics. So it's just the usual centrifugal force equal to gravity. You can solve for everything. And more or less, that is true. But things do change as you come closer and closer to the black hole. And the important point is that there is a minimum radius. There is a last radius at which you can put a particle in a circular orbit. And inside of that radius, you do not have any stable circular orbit. If you put a particle there, it will either just fall in or get kicked out. But it just cannot stay there in a circular orbit. So this is a fundamental property of the Schwarzschild metric and, in fact, the Kerr metric. In the case of the Schwarzschild case, the non-spinning black hole, the radius of this ISCO is 6m, 6gm over c squared. And the interesting thing is that the actual value of the radius depends on the black hole spin. So all the methods that people are thinking about for measuring spin, they all involve somehow or other measuring the radius of the ISCO. Then you say, having measured r ISCO, I then find out how it is related to gm over c squared. So here is this is what theory tells us, that the radius of the ISCO in units of gm over c squared varies as I change the spin parameter of my black hole. It is 6m for a non-spinning black hole. It's 1m for a maximally spinning black hole, and it's a monotonic function in between. So whatever I can measure of r ISCO, and then if I make a ratio of that to gm over c squared, whatever value I get between 1 and 6, I can immediately read off what the spin is. So this is the idea, okay? And the only question is, how are you going to actually measure this ISCO radius? This follows from the second idea. The second idea is that when you have an accretion disk, you've got this gas going around essentially in circular orbits, and it's slowly creeping in, right, due to various stresses which are removing angular momentum from the gas. It spirals in very slowly. You can think of the gas at each instant as pretty much in a local circular orbit. So that works fine until the gas comes to the ISCO. So you've got this steady, very slow, secular inflow. Then you hit the ISCO. And once you cross the ISCO, there are no circular orbits. And that's when the gas is just going to plunge instantaneously into the black hole on a free fall time. So you've got a slow, secular, viscous time, and then sudden free fall time. Based on this picture, what we expect is that an accretion disk would look like this. If you could actually go and look at a guy with X-ray eyes, you would see that there is an accretion disk producing radiation. All that heat is coming out as radiation. There's more and more radiation coming as you come further in, because, of course, that's where most of the energy is being released, until you hit the ISCO, that is this edge. And then once you cross the ISCO, the gas rushes in so quickly that you get essentially no radiation from inside you. So if we could just take a photograph of our disk, we had enough angular resolution, presumably we will see this black center. And all we would have to do is measure out the radius here, and we will know that is the radius of the ISCO. And depending on whether your black hole is non-spinning or moderately spinning or rapidly spinning, the size of this hole will change. Big for the non-spinning guy and pretty small for a very rapidly spinning black hole. The continuum method, which is what we have been using, is a method of trying to estimate this radius from observations without actually being able to resolve the object in an angular sense. It's an idea that was first proposed by Zhang et al. More than 10 years ago, but that was too early. They didn't have the data to really get results. And we kind of picked it up 10 years after they proposed it and have been producing results in the last several years. And Shafi, as I said, the graduate student who was involved in all the early work. So how do we measure this radius? I'm going to give you a little primer on astronomy one. Okay? Astronomy one is, how do you measure the radius of a star? Right? This is something that people have been doing. You have a distant star, which is so distant that it looks like a point in the sky. And it's so distant that even with the best telescope, it looks like a point in the sky. So you can't resolve it and get its angular size. And yet we can measure its radius fairly easily. What we use is the fact that stars are pretty good black bodies. Okay? If you look at the spectrum of a star, it's not a perfect black body. There are all these lines, emission lines, absorption lines, et cetera. But overall shape of the spectrum, like the sun. The sun is a black body at 5,500 degrees Kelvin. No, it's a pretty good description of what the spectrum is. So if you look at a very distant star, and you look at the radiation, and you look at the spectrum, you can find the temperature of the radiation that's coming from the surface. And you can calculate the luminosity of the star. The luminosity of the star is, of course, just the area of the star, 4 pi r squared times sigma t to the 4, where t is measured from the spectrum. The luminosity is also, of course, from the inverse square law, 4 pi d squared times f. D is the distance to the star. F is the flux that you receive here on Earth with some, you know, some photometer. And so, you know, the fact that you've got these two guys will give you a nice simple relation that says r is equal to something. F is a measured quantity. Sigma is just the Stefan-Boltzmann constant. T is a measured quantity from the spectrum. D is also a measured quantity. I'm not going to tell you how, but you know, for many stars, we know how to get distances. So provided you know the distance to a star, you're in business. Even though you don't resolve it in an angular sense, you can get the radius. This won't be a precise radius because it's not a precise black hole, I mean black body. So people have to do, you know, more detailed radiative transfer atmosphere models, and you can get 10%, 20% changes. But you can get a pretty good first approximation to the radius with very simple measurements, and this has been going on for 100 years or more. So our idea is to use the same thing with an accretion disk. So we want to know the radius of this hole in the disk. Of course, the radiation we receive is actually coming from out here. It's coming from a bright ring surrounding this hole. So what we want to do is we want to find out what is the area of this bright ring. Then we will use theory to relate the area of this bright ring to the area of the hole. This just comes from, you know, that's a basic model. And then once you have the radius of the hole, of course, you've got your radius of the ISCO. What do we need? Just in analogy with the star case, we need to know the flux. In this case, it's the flux in X-rays that we receive from the object. We need to know the distance so that we can convert flux to a luminosity. We need to know the temperature. I'm assuming that this is a black body, okay? So I'll come back to this. So assuming this is a good, perfect black body, I need to know the temperature. And here is already one complication. This is not a single temperature black body. A real accretion disk really has temperature varying with radius. It's highest here, and it's decreasing outwards. But the interesting, the important thing is that this is completely calculable. Just from first principles, you know how the flux varies, how the temperature varies. So that is not an uncertainty. It's just, it's a complication, but it's not anything problematic. Okay, so you measure the flux, you measure some characteristic temperature, you measure some distance. And essentially what you measure thereby is the projected area of this hole. Yeah, this is really what you measure. You can easily convince yourself that that's what you're measuring. And then we are faced with this now the second complication here, namely that this is not a sphere. A sphere is a circle in any projection. This is a disk. And so there is a projection factor to worry about. If you measure the area, From that, getting the radius requires knowing what the inclination of the disk is. So we need information on the inclination of our disk. What we do is we assume that the disk is aligned with the orbital plane of the binary. So, you know, like, you know, we discussed, we need some information on the inclination of the binary to get the mass in any case. So we've already got an estimate of that inclination. We assume that the disk is aligned with the same plane and therefore it has the same inclination. This is one of the, I would say, at the moment, uncontrolled approximations in what we are doing. We think there are good reasons for making this approximation, that it's not such a bad idea, but it would be wonderful to check independently that the disk is aligned with the binary. And I will mention very briefly one method that could be used to check this in the future. So for now, we just make this assumption. So once you've got this inclination, you immediately get the radius. And now when I say I get the radius in real units, kilometers or centimeters or whatever, provided I have got all of these quantities. Then, having measured this, I look at this ratio, R is co over m, because I've already measured the mass, and I get my spin parameter by looking at that monotonic curve. Okay, so the idea is very simple. Of course, as I said, it had to wait for 10 years. That's because, you know, it requires a lot of things to all line up. We have to be able to measure these things precisely. You need to select the data carefully. You need distances, which are never easy. You need this inclination, which is a whole game in itself. And yeah, you need to do all the relativity right. And I'm giving you these very simple qualitative arguments, but in practice, you have to worry about everything. You have to worry about blue shifts and red shifts due to motion, gravitational redshift, bending of light, you know, one part of the disk irradiating another part of the disk. All of these effects have to be included. Nothing difficult in principle, but a lot of, you know, model building capabilities to be developed. And that took all of that time. Okay, so that's the idea. Now, all of this will work only if you have a disk that radiates like a black body, or at least almost like a black body with corrections that can be calculated. Okay, this is what works for the case of a star. It's almost a black body, and we know how to do the corrections. Now, black holes, these X-ray binary black holes, they are very interesting objects. They do all sorts of crazy things. They're not just, you know, static things that look always the same. From day to day, month to month, year to year, they do very, very interesting and different things. Fortunately, there are periods of time when their emission is very black body-like. And I'll show you an example. This is one of the objects for which a spin has been measured. This is an object called LMC-X3. This is an X-ray binary in the neighboring galaxy, the Large Magellanic Cloud. This is an X-ray spectrum. This is spectrum, this is mu F mu or EFE or whatever. Flux as a function of the photon energy in KeV. And what you see is a spectrum that looks like this. Nice, smooth, featureless spectrum. And then some extra stuff above 10 KeV. This extra stuff is not consistent with black body emission, okay? This is believed to be from some hot electron, some corona, whatever, but it's only a few percent of the total flux. 95% or more of the flux is coming in this smooth, featureless continuum spectrum, which can be fitted very well with the standard disk model, assuming black body emission. Okay, so that's this red line. There is deviation at lower energies, and this is well understood. This is due to absorption in the interstellar medium. This happens with every X-ray source in the sky. And people have techniques for eliminating this NH. So essentially what you do is you take this data, this part of the spectrum, and you fit three numbers to it. You use the low energy end to solve for this NH. That's a nuisance. Just get it out of the way. Then you're essentially interested in the area under this curve, which is the flux. And you're interested in the position of the peak, which gives you the temperature. So if you can do this for a star, you can do this for an X-ray spectrum like this. So this is what we like about this method, that The X-ray analysis is actually very robust. It doesn't get easier than this in terms of actually modeling something when, you know, nearly 100% of what you're observing is the component you're trying to model. Okay.
Yes. So how do you, and you're fitting a single black body to it?
No, it's not a single black body. This is the multicolor black body model. Now we call it Thorne thin disk model. Yeah, which has, so essentially what we are fitting is, you take the Novikov Thorne model, you're fitting, as, I mean, I'm talking qualitatively of fitting the area and the position of the peak. In practice, you're fitting mass accretion rate m dot and a star, two numbers. You're fitting two numbers.
So m dot is a normalization of some sort.
M dot is proportional to the flux.
Yeah.
And the A star depends on the temperature because, as you know, the more you're spinning, closer in the disk comes. So that's how it works in the actual detailed modeling. But qualitatively, if you think about it, what you're really doing is getting the temperature and flux and getting an area through that ISCO radius and thereby the spin. Yeah. Right. And it's all based on Novikov model. I'll come to that as I go along. You know, is it a reliable model or not? Okay, so this is the good news. It's a soft black body like spectrum. So we can really hope to use some basic physics to make realistic models. Anytime you have these power laws and stuff, there are so much uncertainty on exactly how you make a power law, what is the energy source, what's the physics behind the acceleration of particles. You'll be left with a whole lot of parameters, and at least I wouldn't believe any of the results. When it's this simple, I think there's a chance of being right. Okay. I'll show you one more test that we can do. What we're assuming is black body emission. And black body emission has this nice property that luminosity is just sigma t to the 4 times area, right? So my picture is that my accretion disk comes down to the ISCO. It has some effective area. This is this ring. And if I imagine this accretion system with different rate of feeding of gas, m dot. So sometimes let us say I have less m dot, sometimes I have more m dot. It'll get brighter and dimmer, of course. But the area is always going to be the same. That is, the luminosity is going to be proportional to t to the 4th. So let me show you the equation. So this is a formula. Something like this is going to be satisfied anytime you have a black body source with a fixed area. That if you can measure the luminosity and the temperature, or flux and temperature, which are the two direct things you get from the data, they better be related by this relation, L proportional to T to the 4, with a constant proportionality constant. Okay. Here is one particular source for which, you know, there is a range of data. And you can get these data because, as I said, these sources are changing with time. So you observe it over many months. Today it will be bright. And next Monday, it will be a little fainter. And maybe, you know, next month, it's very dim. So you get a range of luminosity all within this black body state. And in this particular case, there was a factor of 5 or more in luminosity. And of course, sure enough, the temperature also changed. And you plot all of your data in this L versus T plot. And you see whether it agrees with L going as T to the 4. Well, it's trying, OK? Not perfect, but it seems to be at least increasing monotonically, et cetera, et cetera. But it also shows it's not a perfect black body, right? If it was a perfect black body, you would have expected it to be exactly T to the 4. We know that these disks are not perfect black bodies because, you know, people know how to do the radiative transfer in an optically thick disk. And the particular people who do it these days are these folks, Shane Davis, who got his PhD at Santa Barbara doing this kind of work, working with Omar Blaise. And then Ivan Hubeny is the person who had the codes to do all of these radiative transfers. So these guys know how to do radiative transfer, how to calculate deviations from black body in the emission from a disk. So what we can do is we can take this data, apply this model these guys have developed to allow for the deviations from black body, and see how it looks. And this is what it looks like, i.e. raw data, data corrected with a first principles a priori model. right? I mean, that model was not developed to fit this data by any means. It's a first principles calculation of what would happen to the spectrum in a disk with such and such properties. We just plug it in, and we get a lovely LT to the 4 relation. So it gives us confidence that there is a constant area. So that's what this is telling you. There is a constant area in this disk. We think that area is related to the ISK. And that's for the reasons I described. That is, of course, not proved. That's where our theoretical prejudice is coming in. This is what observations can tell you, that there is at least a constant area, i.e. a constant length scale in the accretion disk. Okay, so that's the only extra test that I can tell you for verifying that our assumptions are reasonable. We have measured spin for 7 systems so far using this method. 6 of these are published, or at least posted on the web. This one we haven't yet actually announced, but we are seeing indications for what the spin might be, and I'll give you a number, but take it with some caution because it's not yet finalized. We have another maybe 2 or 3 that are in the works, and I think we will get some numbers in the next year or two. I'm just going to show you a few sources just to give you a sense of how the results look. This is a very interesting source. This is the most distant by far of all these black holes. This guy is in the galaxy M33. And M33 is not really a close by galaxy. It's closer to Andromeda. So it's really nearly a megaparsec away. It's a faint system because it's so far away. And yet, this is one of the systems where we think we can measure spin most accurately. For reasons that I don't want to dwell on, let's just say that this is an eclipsing system. So for the X-ray astronomers, it's an eclipsing system, and therefore we have much better constraints or control on the binary parameters. So this is a truly excellent system. Okay, this is a faint source. So even the best data we have gives us only about 5,000 or 10,000 photons. So what we do is the following. This is a source that has been observed for many, many years by different satellites. And so this is data spanning maybe 10 years. So, you know, various times people look at the sky and they get some information that is saved in the archives. And we go and pull out the data from the archives and analyze it. So every symbol here is a completely independent observation analyzed independently. We are not combining all the data. So each data gives us a separate estimate of the spin parameter. So if you focus on the guys with the largest number of photons, which we call our gold spectra, and really, you know, this is a small number. Typically, you have much, much more than this for galactic X-ray sources. But this is what we have in this particular guy. What you see is that all the observations with the large number of photons agree remarkably well in the estimate of the black hole spin. 0.77, as it turns out. So these 4 guys give you 0.77 plus minus 0.02. As you get fewer and fewer photons, you start getting a scatter, consistent marginally with just a larger error estimate due to the fewer photons. The whole thing is consistent with a single value. But this is all assuming that we know the mass, the distance, and the inclination, all of which are uncertain. So you include all of those uncertainties, our measurement uncertainties, we finally end up with, for this particular source, an estimate of spin of 0.77 plus minus 0.05. This is an honest error estimate, honest in the sense it includes all of our observational uncertainties, the parts that we can control. The real question is, how good is the model? Can you believe the model that has been used to extract this? And I will, you know, that's what I'm going to spend the rest of the talk on, to explore, you know, how far one can go.
Before you were doing that math, typical there, you were talking about an error bar of 50%.
Yeah.
Here you're talking about an error less than 10%.
Yeah, 10%. It's hardly, let me, yeah, no, this is a very good point. It all really comes down to this diagram. And what I would say is, the quantity you're measuring is this vertical axis, right? This is changing not by factor of 2, but factor of 6. So let us say you make a 20% error in something. 10% error is really a small fraction of the factor of 6 range in this quantity. And since you're converting this factor of 6 to a factor 1 range 1 here, and this is a fairly steep curve, and especially as you go closer and closer to 1, it becomes steeper and steeper. This is what allows us to compress the uncertainty in A. So in fact, I will show you in a bit a source for which our spin is close to 1. And here, the uncertainty will be ridiculously small. It's because, you know, we have a fairly large uncertainty in the vertical axis, but since the curve is vertical, it translates to a very small uncertainty in this direction. So this is part of the answer.
The y-axis is also a ratio, right? So do any of those uncertainties cancel out in the ratio that are not?
We add them in the quadrature when we make these estimates.
Just thinking of sine I and things.
This is a very good point. So, no, actually, this is a good point. So our initial error estimates are all based on just adding in quadrature. But this particular source that I showed just now, plus the more recent work, what we do is a kind of a Monte Carlo. So we start with what we know, the measurements, and then we just sample within the uncertainties all of the different parameters. And if I remember right, we put in the I and get both the mass and
it must be 4.
Yeah, no, you're right. I hope we are doing this. If not, I will go back and tell our guys that this is what they should be doing. Yes. Yes, indeed. Because that I is going in more than one place, and the uncertainty in I, we should allow for the correlation, which may help or may make it worse. But whatever it is, we should do it right.
And the same with distance, right? You're always converting angles into
Converting angles
to size.
Yeah, but distance is an independent error. So that we can just add as an orthogonal axis where we put uncertainties.
I just mean it probably affects R and M.
So. Yeah, no, that we include. We include the error in R due to D. We include the error in R due to sine I, right? We include the error in M due to various factors, including sine I. But the fact that sine I appears in both the numerator and the denominator gives the correlation you're talking about. And I know we talked about it, but I'm not sure we're actually doing it. So thank you. I will remember to.
Before that goes away.
Yeah.
This calculation of the ISCO must be, or my bet is, it's in the equatorial plane.
It is the equatorial plane, yes.
And now you said that the accretion disk is in the orbital plane of the binary. Do we know that those match up?
Yeah. No, this is the uncertainty. So here is what theory tells us. Theory tells us if you've got a binary, you will introduce the mass in the binary plane, because it's coming from the companion, so that's the plane in which the gas will come in. As it comes close to the black hole, it will start sensing the spin of the black hole and the metric, and the accretion disk will align itself with the equatorial plane of the black hole due to something called lens steering precession and things like that. So this is the general case is going to be a disk in the orbital plane, then aligning with the perpendicular to the spin of the black hole. And all of the observations we are making, X-rays are all coming from this inner disk. And the question is this inner disk, which is aligned with the spin, the same plane as the orbital plane? So essentially what we are saying is that the black hole spin is orthogonal, or rather parallel to the orbital angular momentum. And this is a reasonable assumption under, you know, astrophysical scenarios, but there are reasons why it could also be wrong. Yeah.
A reasonable assumption is the belief that the angular momentum of the black hole comes from the accretion disk.
No. We can show that the accretion added angular momentum is small. Most of the angular momentum is from the pre-black hole star. So the reasonable argument is the following. Before the black hole formed, we had two stars which were in a binary orbit, and they were close enough that they were tidally completely synchronized. So the angular momentum vector of the binary and the two spin axes were all in the same parallel to each other. And then this star collapsed to the black hole, and it remembered its angular momentum. This is the way we look at it. When we estimate how much you're adding through accretion, our estimates give a small number, few percent. It's not enough to change anything on the time scale.
So
it's get it. So you said the temperature profile of the accretion can be the estimated using it. But doesn't the size of the orbit also?
No. No, because all the action is close to the black hole. So you get all the X-rays from within the first few tens of M. Okay? The outer, the companion star is at 10 to the 6 M. The outer edge of the accretion disk is probably at 50,000 M or 100,000 M. So there's this huge area where the gas is coming in, and it's probably producing some infrared, you know, some optical, some very low energy photons. We are not looking at that, because energetically it's completely unimportant. This is the only part we are interested in, and it only depends on how much mass you're supplying and how much spin you have. The way you introduce the mass is pretty much irrelevant for this calculation. This is also good for us, because remember, we are trying to estimate the size of a hole. If we were receiving radiation from the entire disk, this hole is negligible. The only reason this thing works is that the area that effectively radiates is comparable to the area of the hole. And that's only because everything is concentrated in the middle. Yeah.
At the beginning, you said you might comment on jets. Is that going to allow you to get sort of direct information about
the orientation? Yes. So in fact, let me continue with the sources. Yeah. I will. No. Maybe I should be going to the summary. Right, so this is the first guy I was talking about, okay? This guy I like to show, LMCX3. This source has been studied by so many X-ray satellites over the years. So this is a plot showing data over the last 20 years or 15 years from a variety of X-ray satellites, Ginga data, ASCA data, Bepocyx, RXT, XMR. And each satellite is observed many, many times. So what you do is you take every piece of data, analyze it independently, get an estimate of spin. And the thing we like is, of course, you know, we have large fluctuations in the values. But boy, they really cluster. To have this much consistency across the years, across different missions, and independent observations gives us a lot of confidence that we are measuring something. You know, we think it's the spin, but there's no doubt that there is something repeatable about these systems, that you are getting some measure of length. And then, you know, whether it's the ISCO or what, you know, those are the questions that we still need to address. This is the system, GRS-1915. This guy is famous for its jet. Okay? And this is a system in which we have a pretty good estimate of the orientation of the jet relative to the line of sight. And we have this strong theoretical conviction that the jet is always oriented perpendicular to the accretion disk along the spin axis of the black hole. So in this case, we can take the orientation of the jet and say that that gives us the orientation of the accretion disk. It's really sad, but this is the one guy for which we do not have an independent orbital inclination. What can I say? You know, it would be wonderful if we had both methods in one system, and then we can see how good is our approximation. This guy, so the only inclination information we have here is the inclination of the jet, and that's what we use, okay? So this is my champion, the guy with the spin, we think, between 0.98 and 1. And the reason why it's such a narrow error bar is what I described earlier, the fact that that curve comes pretty much vertically down. So even though our estimate of our ISCO is fairly uncertain, maybe 20%, 30% off, when projected on the A star axis, it gives a very small error bar. So anyway, it's close to 1. So here are all the values. I have listed the 7 systems, of which 1 is, as I said, still not quite finished, but we think it's heading towards 0.5. I've ordered them by the magnitude of the spin, so it kind of goes all the way from 0 to 1. So it does look like these black holes and X-ray binaries don't have one unique spin or one characteristic value, but spread all over. This guy is really an interesting source, and so, you know, a very interesting question to ask is whether all the weird properties of this source are somehow related to the spin or not. It's too soon to talk about that, but just mention. Okay, so this is what we've got. What I'm going to do for the rest of the talk is try and assess how much to believe these numbers. Okay? I told you the philosophy and the methodology, but then you have to ask, you know, the assumptions you make, how much can you trust them, and what can you do if you don't trust them. First, I'll remind you what are the good things about this method. When we take the X-ray data and analyze it, we are doing, I would consider, the most robust kind of data analysis. We're just asking for two numbers, fx, tx. This is this diagram. And this, I think any expert astronomer will tell you, is a pretty easy game to play, especially when there are no additional components here. There is additional stuff way out here at a few percent, but it doesn't interfere with your ability to interpret this part of the spectrum. This is the strength of the spectrum. It comes with its baggage, and the baggage is that since you're asking for so little from the X-ray data, you need additional data to supply all the other numbers that the method needs. Because we need an estimate of the mass, we need an estimate of the distance, we need an estimate of the inclination. These all come from optical, infrared, radio observations. Plus, we need to make this assumption that when we measure the inclination of the binary, it is the same as the inclination of the disk. That is an open question at the moment. So but I'll go to that directly now. That's the next slide I'm going to show. And then there are some very interesting theoretical issues on the model itself. Exactly how flux varies with the radius, how much area does this bright ring have? You know, I just said you can ignore the outside, you can only look at the inside. You know, how good is all of that? So that's in fact what I'm going to spend most of my time on. Here, okay, this will go into all of that as I go along. So let me go to the disk inclination. The disk inclination, so we already mentioned that in principle, if the black hole spin axis is misaligned with the orbital angular momentum, then the disk would be tilted in some other orientation. And then all the numbers we get would just be wrong, because we are using this orientation, but the real orientation is this. Then it's the cosine of this inclination that comes in the calculations, and if you get cosine of I wrong, of course your answers are going to be wrong. There is a way of directly inferring the inclination of the disk. This is by doing polarimetry of the X-ray emission. This is a well-known thing in astronomy, that anytime you've got an atmosphere, especially a scattering atmosphere with electrons on the surface, so if there's some radiation escaping from the surface, then it scatters off an electron and then reaches you. If you look at the disk face on, of course, by symmetry, there is no polarization. If you look at it edge on, it's going to be primarily polarized in this direction. The E vector is going to be like this, because the photon comes and then scatters and comes to you. So in fact, it's a fairly simple business to calculate how the degree of polarization varies as a function of the inclination angle of the disk. And this was done by Chandrasekhar in his book. And you know, this is just known as Chandrasekhar formula. You just have to fold it with all of our GR ray tracing and calculate this. So when you calculate, what you find is that the polarization changes by a fair amount. It can go all the way from zero polarization fraction to up to 5% polarization fraction. So if you can make a sensitive polarization measurement of one of these systems, you would then have an independent estimate of the inclination of the disk, which you could then use in your model. You can also use it to compare it to the binary orbit and see whether or not there is a misalignment. There is no polarimeter in space right now. People who propose these projects tell me that with a pretty cheap mission, one of these so-called SMECs, which is a small explorer class missions, they can measure polarization to 0.1%. Okay? Now, I don't know if the 0.1 is really doable, but this is what they honestly calculate and tell you. But let's say it's 0.5%. But you know, 0.5% is still pretty good when the range is 5%. So I believe with any decent polarimeter in space, we would actually have a handle on this inclination. We can check our assumptions and maybe even make direct measurements. So this is something to wait for in the future. Right now, all we have is orbital inclination and we stick to it. Let me come to the theoretical question. This is the The most serious thing, this is where, in fact, most of my work and my students' work has been focused, which is we have a model, which is, in fact, the famous Novikov-Thorn model of 1973, which tells you how, for a given spin of the black hole, how the flux of the disk varies with radius, and corresponding, of course, how the temperature varies with radius. And, you know, this is just this schematic figure, but flux varies with radius for a non-spinning black hole, something like this. It vanishes at the ISCO, which is 6 gm over c squared, so there's no radiation from inside the ISCO, that's this black region. There is a very bright region surrounding that is this white region, and the exact shape is calculated from first principles. It's just energy conservation, there are really not many uncertainties there. The one uncertainty I'll mention in the next slide. And then it falls off very rapidly, in fact, there's very little energy coming out from larger radii. The one uncertainty is a boundary condition. So when Novikov and Thorn did their work, which was following on Chakura and Sunyaya, 1973, they assumed that the torque, which is removing angular momentum from a gas, the torque vanishes when the gas hits the ISCO. It's a very plausible assumption. Because you know, the ISCO is this point where you're going from slow evolution to sudden free fall. Right? I think of it like water coming along a river and going over the waterfall. It's just gone. So clearly, as you go over the waterfall, you're going into a regime where this water is no longer talking to the water behind it. Right? It's just gone. It's causally disconnected in terms of signals. And that's what these guys assume. They assume that at the ISCO, the gas in the disk pretty much loses all contact with what is falling into the black hole, which means there is no stress at this point. Zero torque or zero stress boundary condition was the assumption they made. This seemed reasonable then, but then as people kept working on these disk models and realized that there are magnetic fields, and magnetic field lines can stretch from the disk into this plunging region, and you know that acts like a spring or a tension line, maybe that can actually give you a stress, torque, and additional things. So there's this big question. How much stress do you have, really, at the ISCO? Could it be so large that it completely screws up this model? So instead of the flux going to zero, which is for zero torque, if I have substantial torque, the flux may actually do something else. So the shape would be different, and in fact, the flux would also be non-zero inside the ISCO, and you know, the whole model just falls apart. Fortunately, to our rescue came Nyayesh and Bogdan Paczynski. This is a paper in 2003, though I think I talked to you already in 2001 when I visited Princeton. He was a graduate student then. And you know, probably this is the only graduate student paper that I heard about and remembered several years later, because at this time I was not working on black hole spin. But a few years later when we started doing black hole spin, I remembered this paper. This paper basically said, yes, in principle, you can have a stress across the ISCO, but if your disk is geometrically thin, don't worry about it. That's what they said. And in fact, as you go to the limit of infinitely thin accretion disk, the stress at the ISCO will vanish. And of course, the guys who were talking about magnetic fields disagreed violently, and I think there was a lot of fireworks. I was not involved, but you know, Nyayesh would tell you the story.
That's why it took 2 years.
That's why it took 2 years to publish. Okay, there you have it, because I heard about it in 2001. Okay, so anyway, we said, look, let's hope these guys are right, but let's check. So we have done two things. First thing is, Rebecca basically redid their calculation, but you know, but with a more elaborate setup and a more thorough study of all the parameters, and I won't go into the details. This was a hydrodynamic model, so-called height-integrated 1D model. None of the details matter. Bottom line is we completely agreed with Afshori and Paczynski. So at the level of approximations that they did, we got exactly the answer they got, namely that the thinner you make your disk, the better this no-torque condition is, and the better the Novikov-Thorn model is. Good. But this still is not good enough because, of course, the counter argument was all based on magnetic fields. And this hydro model does not have magnetic fields. So the obvious thing is we have to do a proper MHD model and check for that case whether or not the Schrödinger-Pechinsky result is right. And this is what Rebecca has been doing for the last couple of years, and then, you know, as I said, she graduated. So what we have done is a full MHD simulation of an accretion disk in the proper metric, GR metric of a black hole. So you start with some magnetized gas, put it in orbit around the black hole, let it accrete, let it do its own thing in terms of stresses and all that. That is to say, it develops its own magnetic field, develops its own stresses. We don't tell it what to do at this point. It will know what to do at this point when it falls in, and then we go and just look at the results. Many people have been doing these kinds of simulations for the last 5 years, or maybe even 10 years, GR for the 5 years, but they have not done thin disks. Okay, the key point of Nyayesh's work is you should be looking at thin disks, and everybody had been doing thick disks. And sure enough, thick disks have all sorts of stresses at the ISCO, inside the ISCO, et cetera. So this was, I would say, this is the first really thin accretion disk that's been simulated on the computer. And the particular disk we simulated has a thickness, H over R, less than 0.1. Depending on which measure of thickness you use, it's either about 0.05 or 0.07, which is really thin, much thinner than anything others have done. There is some parallel work I just mentioned, Reynolds and Fabian, Krolik and Hawley, but I'm just going to describe the results that we have got. I could show you a movie, but let's not look at the movie. You know, this is Rebecca made a movie of what the simulation does. I'll just show you the result. Let's start with what Novikov and Thorn say. Or Shakuratsunya, it's the same thing. You have gas, which is essentially in a Keplerian circular orbit, which is steadily moving in on Keplerian orbits, bit by bit by bit. So at each radius, the angular momentum of your gas is just the local Keplerian value until you hit the ISCO. And at the ISCO, you pretty much detach from the disk and you fall in with constant angular momentum, right? You're just free falling. So if you look at a parameter like specific angular momentum of the accreting gas, this is what Novikov and Thorn say. It increases essentially a square root of R as you go further out, or rather it decreases as you come in. Then it levels off when you hit the ISCO at 6m, and then it is constant inside this point. The guys who say that magnetic fields completely invalidate this picture, their mental picture is that, sure, it will decrease like the Keplerian angular momentum profile here, but it won't level up. It will just keep on, right? So in fact, there is no difference across the ISCO. It just keeps going. Of course, they can't tell you how low it goes, but the point is there's a huge amount of action going on inside ISCO. That's the other extreme. Our simulation shows this. So this is from the three-dimensional MHD simulation in steady state. We have really expanded the scale here, okay? This is really just a 2% deviation from the Novikov and Thorn value. So yeah, I've expanded it so you can see the difference. But our bottom line is, this is not at all a bad approximation to what really goes on. It would be an error at the level of 2% for a really thin accretion disk. But 2% we can live with. 2% may correspond to maybe 5% in A star, but that's okay. It's not a 50% or 100% error. So this is our current understanding of what the torque does. There is still a big gap between torque and what the flux does. So that's really, of course, what we measure. This requires some understanding of dissipation, and we are still a little uncertain. We don't want to report anything until we know what we're doing. Okay? This part we are very confident about. We are also, of course, exploring what happens for different black hole spins, different thicknesses. There's a lot of experiments to be done. It's very expensive experiments. This thing ran for, you know, a few months on an IBM Blue Gene, so you can't do many, many experiments. But we have the code and we can do it. I think we will start finding answers. So based on this, we would say we are cautiously optimistic that the technology that we are using, methodology is okay. I didn't mention this, but all the data that we are analyzing correspond to geometrically thin disks. Okay? And I won't go into the details why we are so confident, but they are very thin disks in the regime that we have simulated. In fact, the thicker disk data, we don't even look at them, but when we do look at them, we get some crazy results. So we just keep them aside. We only look at the thin disk data. So I think it's okay, with the one caveat about the inclination angle. More work is needed. Let me know. Jets, you want to talk about jets? No? Let's not talk about jets. I will say this. We do have two methods, right? There is this method that I'm describing and the iron line method. Just, I think yesterday, there was a paper posted on AstroPA, and I haven't had time to read it, but I just looked at the numbers. Using the iron line on X-ray binaries, and the numbers don't agree with our numbers. I don't know what it means. So, you know, this we will figure out in the years to come. But I hope the time will come when both methods are applied systematically and cross-compared and differences are resolved. And maybe we will then reach a point when we can start believing all of our results. So what can I say? The bottom line is we are in the process of measuring the second magic parameter of a black hole. We've made a good beginning, and I think this is going to keep improving, and in a few years we'll start having some believable and fairly large sample of measurements. And then, of course, we would like to really do tests of gravity using those measurements. I still don't know how we will do it. We are still working on this first step, measuring spin. Thanks.
Questions? If you compare your spin to angular momentum, how would it compare to angular momentum of an object star or a pulsar or something else?
It's
a little bit changes.
Well, I think, you know, the angular momentum of the free black hole star could be anything. It depends on the history of the star. Massive stars from which these black holes form are typically spinning fairly rapidly. But these are binary systems. So once you say it's in a binary, it is tidally locked, we think, to the binary. So its spin is tied to the orbital period of the binary. And so there is actually one group in Stony Brook, Brown and company, who use the binary to predict how much angular momentum the star would have had before it collapsed, what kind of spin it should produce as a result of collapse, and then see whether or not it agrees with what we have measured, right? And I must say, I'm amazed, but for several of our systems, they actually agree rather well. But then there are a few where they disagree violently. Their numbers are completely off. That's the best we can do. Otherwise, it's very hard to predict what the angular momentum is going to be for an isolated black hole, for instance. Yeah.
But you can't, I mean, the thing that struck me is the wide range. Okay, so you go from 0.2 to 1, which means that there's a big range in initial angular momentum, because you can't get that from secular effects later on, because the mass ratios are too large. So it has to be natal spin, basically.
So according to Brown and company, that's a wide range of orbital periods, the binaries. This is Brown's story.
Right, but you know that.
That's what he does. Since we know the orbital periods, he uses that to predict what it should be.
But does he predict a range? I mean, let's forget about individual objects. Does he get the range from 0.2 to 1? That's the
key. He doesn't get the highest values. So the large discrepancy, the 0.98, for instance, I think he predicts 0.3 or something. Then he's got a story. He says, oh, in this particular case, actually accretion did do a lot. So, you know, Lee's point. We think accretion could not have done anything, but he's got a scenario with super addicted accretion that
it can't because the mass ratios. How do you?
Oh, no. He claims that the companion star was a lot more massive in the past and transferred 2/3 of its mass in a cataclysmic event and spun this black hole up. So today it looks like a low mass star. So, you know, that's scenario stuff. you can take it, or you didn't believe it. But for several systems, he does agree. And I agree with you, you can't get the entire range, but he is getting some part of that range from this particular scenario. Yeah. The 0.98, I still don't understand how it acquired that much spin. It's a very difficult system to understand.
Other questions? Mike? You flashed one of your transparencies of this continuum fitting method doesn't work on the supermassive.
Yes.
Is that why? Is they don't have inclination?
No. But we don't have the inclination. That's part of the problem. We have excellent distances. It's one of these crazy things. We have much better distances to distant supermassive black holes because we know the distance scale of the universe much better than within our own galaxy. This is, you know, so distance is great. Mass is shaky. But the hardest part is really the black body. AGN disks do not behave like good black bodies. They are much more complicated with lots of lines. They are in a very, very complicated region of the spectrum. They're optical ultraviolet. That's not a good place to be. X-rays are really much cleaner at these temperatures. So that, I think, is the biggest headache. And the mass is the second biggest headache. We don't have good enough masses for the more distant supermassive black hole. So my own belief is that the only way you're going to measure the spin of the big black holes is through the ion line. But I won't believe those ion line methods until they have been calibrated on the X-ray violence. And I hope the day will come when both methods will give at least agreeable results, and then we can start applying.
The one last question I wish prior.
So the big problem here, or one of the main problems, is with the black body temperature. And you're using X-rays here, which gives you probably something closer to a color temperature.
Color temperature, yes.
So, but they, you know, you should be able to look at these in the far UV and do a check. And you get nothing in the far UV.
UV is so far off in the distant wing of the disk.
You don't have any throw there.
No, you can make measurements, but you can't trust anything because it's all irradiation. You know, when you make measurements in UV or optical or infrared, you are not measuring Novikov or flux. Novikov or flux is the internal energy generation in the disk.
Yeah.
You can trust that in the engine, the real engine part of the system. But out here, it's a minor perturbation. The bulk of what you see here is really what has been irradiated from the inside and then reprocessed and re-radiated.
Okay, so you're only seeing further out in the far UV, and so you have no connection to what's going on. So you're
unfortunately kind of all you can do. Unfortunately, yes.
Okay, so if I guess no other question, let's thank Ramesh. So Ramesh is going to be here for the next couple of hours if we're going to talk to him. Catch him before that.